This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, the history of warfare, says Victor David Hansen, is predominantly a history of Western victory. It's not because of environment or brains or moral superiority, says this military scholar. It's because Western culture turns out the most devastating armies on the planet. Will the West's knack for battle win the war on terrorism? First, a report out of Great Britain that Osama bin Laden has acquired nuclear materials. According to reporter Philip Webster of the Times of London, British intelligence sources are concerned that Osama bin Laden has the capability to build a so-called dirty bomb, a conventional explosive mixed with nuclear waste that could contaminate a limited area with radioactivity. I spoke to Webster earlier today.
The sources I spoke to yesterday on this are very nervous about saying too much about what they think bin Laden has got. There's always been this argument, if you start talking about bin Laden having nuclear material, nuclear weapons, it's alarmist, it makes the country more worried. But we know that he's, or the sources to whom I spoke, know that he has material. As far as they know, as we wrote this morning, he has no capability yet to develop them into a weapon with which he could launch a nuclear attack.
So what are the distinctions you're drawing between material and weapon, and what does it mean in terms of delivery or real threat?
Well, it's very carefully worded, and it was carefully worded on the basis of this point about not causing undue alarm, but of course showing why the West, why Bush and why Blair are so keen to get this man. They've been saying throughout that if he could do worse, he would. And something has been driving those statements. Now, the intelligence sources to whom I spoke have seen reports suggesting that he has got the material with which you could make these so-called, quote, dirty bombs, which would only affect a very small area. It would cause a lot of damage in that particular area. It would cause that area to be evacuated.
What is supposed to have been the source of this material?
Well, according to my sources and according to the sources of one broadcasting organization in Britain last night that also ran the story, was Pakistan. Not, of course, officially. The feeling is that this material has come to bin Laden, come to al-Qaeda illegally from Pakistan. There's well-documented evidence, as you probably know, that for at least 8 years, the al-Qaeda organization has had its agents traveling around the world trying to buy up nuclear material. Tony Blair in London today, significantly, after committing British forces, British ground forces, to action in Afghanistan, gave a warning that if bin Laden wasn't stopped, he could well try to perpetrate nuclear, chemical, and biological attack in future.
And he specifically used the word nuclear.
He used the word nuclear. It's not a word they use very often. Up until now, we've heard him say a lot about biological and chemical warfare. Today, as he spoke to British Forces Radio, talking to those people, who some of whom will be going out to Afghanistan, he used the word nuclear, and that has been taken here as being very significant.
And you're suggesting that concern over this may be in some part behind the speed with which the West, the U.S. and U.K. at least, have gone militarily into Afghanistan.
I think over here we were always surprised with the speed with which George Bush himself, first of all, said that American forces were going to be committed to action inside Afghanistan and that they were going to go after bin Laden and that they wanted him dead or alive. It was done very quickly. We know the terrorist network spreads across many countries, but clearly there was an imperative from a very early stage that this guy, one way or another, has got to be stopped. It's not easy to develop a nuclear program from a cave in Afghanistan, quite obviously, but it probably is. It is not beyond his skill or his wit to have come up with some pretty low-level but lethal nuclear devices, and that's clearly the fear. Nobody tells journalists about these things by accident. Clearly somebody in a position of authority wanted this information out into the public domain.
And what was the level of certainty attached to the observations that these sources were making? Do they feel certain that these materials are in the hands of Osama bin Laden's organization, or it's simply a fear?
There were the sources to whom I spoke yesterday had no doubt about two things. One was that he had material, and they were absolutely convinced of that. But they were pretty well equally convinced that at this stage he doesn't have the wherewithal, the knowledge, the know-how to launch any kind of significant nuclear attack. They were absolutely clear on that. And in telling me the first part, if you like, they also insisted that the second part was equally important. But clearly, there are reports circulating in intelligence circles at the moment that are causing great alarm. It does, to me, explain the urgency with which they've gone after him.
Philip Webster is a reporter for the Times of London. I spoke to him earlier today. Military historian Victor Davis Hanson says that war is the ultimate expression of cultural values. And the West has triumphed from the battlefields of ancient Greece to the Battle of Midway, he says, because its armies are so culturally equipped to carry out a relentless mission of annihilation. How does that view play out on the rugged terrain of Afghanistan and in the shadowy world of terror? Victor David Hanson joins us now from Fresno, California. He's a military historian and professor of classics at California State University at Fresno, and the author of Carnage and Culture, Landmark Battles in the Rise of Western Power. Welcome, Victor David Hanson.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. Also, in the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening, Tom.
Here's the question. Does Western culture breed bloody victory in war? When the going gets tough, does freedom and individualism trump religious fanaticism and terror? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Victor Davis Hanson, you've got a provocative thesis here. Please outline for us, how do you see Western cultural values driving Western military power?
Well, the West, and when we say Western culture, we mean things like individualism, rational inquiry apart from religion, consensual government, technology that's spawned by rationalism, faith in the middle class. All of these things in peacetime, we know that it is the foundation for great historical, literary, and political achievements. But when they're transferred to the battlefield, it means that Western armies have a unique idea of discipline, not individual prowess so much as group discipline. They fire on volleys, they march in time and on orders. They have a superior technology because it's the fruits of rationalism, military technology. They have a civilian audit that checks military prowess and advises and sometimes disagrees with generals. They have an idea that the soldier has rights and responsibilities, and they're not necessarily drafted mercenaries. You put all that together, and it means across time and space that Western or European or Western armies have been able to project military power. It's not commiserate with a rather small size of Europe and its population in historical terms. They have the ability, in other words, to trump what usually makes armies win or lose: numbers, logistics, a bad day, a genius like Hannibal. All those things can make an army win or lose, but over time, the Western system allows latitude for that and allows a defeat like Thermopylae or Cannae or the first disaster in Mexico City under Cortez or Little Bighorn. Victor, all of those things can be overcome.
Victor Davis Hanson, you know that we're going to want you to talk about that theory in the context of the current conflict. But before we go there, please give us some key examples from history and outline or show us, if you would, how they illustrate this thesis.
Greece is only a small country. It's got less than 50,000 square miles and a population in antiquity of less than 2 million, yet it defeated an empire like Persia that had a million square miles and 70 million subjects. And we know from the Battle of Salamis and Plataea, the Greeks believed it was because of freedom that people had the right to speak, to criticize their generals, to argue back and forth. Their generals fought among them. They were not on the throne like Xerxes. In the case of Rome had the unfortunate experience of meeting a genius like Hannibal, but after the Battle of Cannae, in which the Romans were annihilated, within 6 months they had a bigger army than Hannibal did. Why? Because they had the ability to appeal to citizens who were part of a Republican form of government and felt that they had a stake in their own society's destiny in a way that mercenaries and the elite at Carthage did not have.
There's the idea of freedom. There's the idea of democracy. Cortez was not coming from such a democratic Spain. Victor Davis?
Yeah, didn't Hanson, quite.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, we lost you for a second.
I'm sorry. Spain, we must remember, even as bad as Inquisition was and the Reconquista, it still had a tradition of freedom and legality that was not true of the Aztecs. For example, a Spanish nobleman, a Hidalgo that was in Mexico City, had an ability to approach, to criticize, and to consult with Cortez that was impossible for an Aztec subject to do to Montezuma, who was on a bier and could not be even approached or touched by his subjects. But the main thing to remember about that example is Spanish rationalism gave them a degree of technological superiority that was unknown among the Aztecs. There was all the ingredients for gunpowder right outside Mexico City that lay under the ground untouched. Within a year after landing, Cortez was not only making his own gunpowder, but preparing to cast bronze cannon.
So there comes free inquiry as the basis for science. What about in the 19th and 20th centuries, more recent?
Yes, one of the lasting legacies of the West is this idea of discipline. And that goes back really to the phalanx and the legion. But in the 20th century, it manifests itself in the idea that Western armies try to have an egalitarian or an idea that each man is gauged heroic or cowardly to the degree not how many kills he does, not how many prisoners he takes, but how well he protects the man on his side, follows orders, shoots on order, retreats or falls back or advances depending on what his group does. And that means that it's something like the Battle of Rorke's Strip where the British Army, about 93 active redcoats held off 4,000 Zulus. Zulus had good weapons they'd captured the night before at Isiolo. They surrounded the British, but they did not know how to fire on orders, or they did not know how to retreat back to a bunker in a group. That was mostly individual warfare.
So there's discipline, and you're pointing to a cultural route. What about in World War II? Example there?
Yeah, there's a good one at Midway. There, the United States was unprepared. As you know, on December 8th, we woke up to a society, Japan, that had been westernized. That is, in the end of the 19th century, they had adopted lock, stock, and barrel German, French, and English technology and organization. They didn't quite become Western in their sense of Republican government, individual freedom, and that was their undoing. Because at Midway, we had some very bizarre, unique, and eccentric code breakers that would have never been able to operate under the Japanese imperial system. They had cracked the codes. When the battle itself took place, Admiral Spruance, Admiral Nimitz were communicating all the time back and forth, whereas Japanese admirals followed a set plan established by Admiral Yamamoto in which they could not defer or alterate or change or adopt because of this lack of tradition of individualism. And then also, at the Battle of Coral Sea, each side had lost a damaged carrier, but the difference was that the Japanese carriers went into dry dock in Japan and sat there for 6 months while bureaucrats and people waited for orders, while the Yorktown went into Pearl Harbor. Mm. When it arrived, pipe fitters, welders, machinists on their own
jumped right on it,
and that Yorktown was back out in the water in 72 hours.
Jack Beatty, you hear the lineage of glory that Victor Davis Hanson is describing here. Does it give you comfort? We're going to talk about this, but in brief, give you comfort as we face this new conflict?
Well, you know, when the Yorktown arrived at Pearl, Admiral Nimitz put on his hip boots and went right down and looked at the keel, and he said, "You know, you got 48 hours or something to get this ship out of there."
Yeah, we have a wonderful picture of him there.
Indeed, there is.
He was laying down the law.
He was laying down the law, and they were following it. Obviously, it's societies that are at war, and we have a much more open and technologically advanced society that praises, that values things that are going to pay off in war.
But here's the question. Is history a good guide to predicting the outcome of this new war? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255 or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the new book from Victor David Hansen, Carnage and Culture, Landmark Battles in the Rise of Western Power, the thesis that the culture of the West gives it a unique capacity to prosecute brutally devastating war, and that is borne out in examples over centuries and more. What do you think? Is the West destined by culture and values to victory in war? To victory in this new war? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, it is quite a remarkable lineup of battles there. I expect that a different observer might cite a different battles with victory that didn't go to the West, and I don't have no doubt that our listeners will alert us to some of those. But how do you respond to the general idea that the West is this fantastically well-oiled fighting machine because of its culture?
Well, again, it seems to me just to be an inarguable proposition. There's a famous from the Zulu War, which the Battle of Rorke's Drift took place. There's a famous couplet of, I think, Hilaire Belloc's that sort of gives the flavor of the Western superiority. It goes, "Thank God that we have got the Gatling gun and they have not." And having the Gatling gun, that is to say, having industrial capacity, has been a key to the West's strength, not only militarily, but in terms of its economy. And many of the wars that it has engaged in have been industrial wars, and they have been, yes, these individual matters have counted a lot, but so has just the possession of the Gatling gun, of the technological edge. The trouble is with this thesis is that, in the 20th century, there are some counterexamples. Vietnam, for example, where we were not successful. Korea, where we, against two land powers, really fought to a draw. And, of course, the French in Vietnam as well. Which isn't to say that in over the long term these things haven't mattered, but that it hasn't been applying technology, I think, has been both the West's strength and its weakness. I mean, in Vietnam, we seem to think that we could kind of bomb our way to victory against the evidence from the Second World War that strategic bombing was actually counterproductive, that it actually gave the enemy, raised enemy morale and even enemy production in Japan and in Germany. Mm. And we applied that to the primitive pre-industrial economy of North Vietnam, and it didn't work. And also, we weren't fighting for our existence there. It was an optional war, and we fought it in that way. Mm-hmm. The current war, though, is not optional. Not our existence, but much of our peace of mind and perhaps our lives are at stake. And we don't want to make the same mistake of fighting just the techno war, the industrial war, the bombing war, and forgetting that this is really all about, in the end, hearts and minds, to bring a hoary phrase from the Vietnam War. Mm. And maybe the best way to win hearts and minds is not through bombing, but almost a kind of retail war by turning people against the Taliban, by turning them against al-Qaeda, by intelligence, by spying. In short, by something less than ferocity and more like guile political deafness.
It's going to take some great deafness. Victor Davis Hanson, how do you see your sweeping thesis about Western culture fueling Western power in war applying to this current situation?
I'd just like to say, just for a minute, that in Vietnam, that was the worst scenario possible. You had a citizenry that was divided over the morality of the war. You had two nuclear powers who had westernized technology on the borders of Vietnam, 7,000 miles away. And yet, for example, at the Battle of Tet in January 1968, the United States, during a truce, was attacked, and its allies had lost 1,500 people and killed over 40,000 combatants and ruined the North Vietnamese in South Vietnam for over a year. So if you look at the battles per se, that militarily, I think it supports the thesis, but the American
And yet strategically, Tet was a victory for the North Vietnamese because of its effect on the American public.
Effect because the American people were told right before Tet that the war was going to be over very shortly, and they gauged 1,500 losses in a very different way than the North Vietnamese gauged 40,000 being lost.
And we see how vain a purely military victory can be in a modern conflict.
Vietnam certainly
came out as a defeat, and I think there's a lot of concern right now that we're looking at echoes or potential echoes of Vietnam.
That's one of the theses of my book, that in the West, you have this idea of open, free criticism of the government and the military. And in the long run, it can be advantageous, but sometimes it can be counterproductive tactically. In this present, I think we have to just stop and take a breath and remember that, like Pearl Harbor or like any Western defeat where we were surprised, after the Twin Towers, what's happened? Mm-hmm. They've killed about two or three Americans after we were caught on to that peril, and we have an army over 6,000 miles away who's absolutely devastated most of the command and control of the Taliban and has lost no planes and perhaps two people killed in an accident and has got people fighting among each other, and it's got most of the world quite frightened in that part of the world, not what they say in the streets, but their leaders because of their fear of American power. So in a mere 3.5 weeks, the United States has projected power beyond what I thought would be possible. It's amazing, the technology, the discipline, the skill in which our armed forces are bringing war right to the enemy. And there's this moral edge that it's very important to stress to Americans. It's not morally equivalent to deliberately try to kill civilians in towers while they're at work and kill 6,000 of them and then risk American lives in Afghanistan with the deliberate intention of not hitting civilians against an enemy who are fascist and killers and who are hiding in mosques, trying to threaten to poison their own people and hiding in domestic buses and still not trying to unleash American power. And the idea that these are morally equivalent is very depressing to see among some people in America.
I don't see it very widespread so far. We'll talk about that. We're looking this hour at Western culture, culture in general, as a taproot of military power, Western culture in particular. Are you comforted by the idea that your culture supports an unmatched fighting machine? Do you believe it does? And do you believe that will make us successful in this current new kind of war on terrorism? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Welcome, David.
Hi.
Hi.
I thank you for this discussion and argument. I also understand, you know, what's happened with Korea and Vietnam and Iran as well.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my real question is, since you're looking at this from a historical perspective, is try to explain why the nations of Islam between 500 and 1100 were so successful against the West.
Yeah,
that's something I'd like you to talk about. Then I'll get off the line so I can listen.
Okay, we'll go right at that. That's a great question. Victor Davis Hanson, how about it? What about the heyday of Islamic military prowess?
I think he's referring to the 7th century through the 12th century.
All right.
You must remember that Europe had extended power under Roman times across the Mediterranean to North Africa and all the way into the Euphrates and Tigris river valleys. So in other words, Europe was basically in control of the known world. With the collapse of the Roman Empire, and more importantly, the rivalry between Orthodox Christianity in the East and Roman Catholicism in the West, which also was a problem because of the just war doctrine, that is, the idea that there was a strong strain of pacifism, then Asia and Africa became under indigenous control again, as you might expect. But when Islam tried to get into Europe, as they tried to in the Eastern Europe, and as they tried to in southern Spain, they were more or less stopped, and there was a stasis between East and West for 500 years. You must remember the Crusades in the 12th and 13th century. The West, very small numbers, less than 30,000 people, had the logistical support and the transportation capability to send Western armies for good or evil. Again, I'm talking about dynamism now, into the heart of Islam, whereas I don't think it was possible for Saladin to have the logistical or transportation capability to go into Central Europe or to London. So even in the bleak time when, and then if you look at the Ottomans, when Europe was racked by Protestant, Orthodox, and Catholic rivalry, it nevertheless kept Europe almost completely free, Central Europe and England free. And then, of course, when you open up the Atlantic trade routes and the discovery of the Americas and the trade routes into China and India, then you see the gradual destruction of Ottoman Empire's influence.
And coming back to today, what about the examples of Vietnam and Korea? It keeps coming up. If we can win militarily and still lose a war, what does that say to us about the conflict that we're in right now? You describe admiringly, and who couldn't be logistically, the amazing feat of getting all these weapons out there surrounding and inside Afghanistan. But does that give you confidence as a historian that we will necessarily win the larger campaign, the larger war here?
Those are two different questions. Militarily, Western cultures have the ability to defeat the enemy. We could have defeated the enemy at will in Vietnam if that's what the American people had decided they wanted.
But yet war is more than that, as you
exactly
know.
That's exactly correct. So in the West, we have this dual legacy that we believe, or at least we try to believe, in consensual government and freedom in the individual. So when we're fighting in a war, when those goals are not clearly articulated, or our allies do not share those, then we have problems. We had no problem in World War II, and I think none in Korea. But in Vietnam, there was the argument, and I thought it was an incorrect one, that the North Vietnamese were the moral equivalents of the South Vietnamese. I think the events in 1975, when the North Vietnamese took over, and there was over 1 million boat people and perhaps 250,000 killed, and the elections were held, and 99.9% voted for the communists, was a wake-up call to Americans. So we have this problem of we have to have 100% moral certainty that our cause is just or the people fail to support it. This is a different war, though, because if you're a feminist, these people want to put women back in the 13th century. If you believe in gay rights, they want to execute homosexuals. If you believe in religious tolerance, they don't believe in any religious tolerance. If you believe that the war is over there, we don't want to get involved, they attacked us first and killed 6,000 people at work. And so all of the traditional moral objections to war in the last three decades simply don't apply here.
Jack Beatty, let me put that to you. How do you feel about the balance that the United States has right now of technological superiority and what's on the other side, moral cohesion, subtlety, persuasiveness to the world, to the Islamic world?
Yeah, that's the rub. You put it, I think, very well. You can succeed militarily and yet lose the war. And that's what's at stake here. Richard Holbrooke, the former UN ambassador, said the other day that a mass murderer is winning the battle for, hearts and minds in the Islamic world. I mean, that is just an amazing statement. And we have to fight the war in such a way that we don't, make the peace, what comes after it, haunted with yet more terrorists. And as I said before, I think the problem with the Western way of war, the great battle theory, the use of overwhelming force and so on, is that it doesn't seem, at least on the surface, to be immediately apposite to this particular challenge, just as I don't think Vietnam was apposite to that challenge, and we didn't succeed there. Admittedly, we succeeded militarily, but we lost the war, or we didn't get our political objective. So I think that there's this kind of cultural, this clash of cultures, but not so much of, we're with the machines and they're with the caves. And it's hard to bring them together.
We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's bring some in. We're talking about the cultural roots of Western success in war. Is the West destined by culture and values to victory in war, to victory in this new war? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Leonid is on the line. Welcome, Leonid.
Yes, hello. Actually, wonderful discussion. Enjoying it a great deal. I'm a recent immigrant from Russia, as you might well hear.
We somehow guessed you might be.
Yes, okay. Thank you. And actually, I had a question related to Russia, because if you look at Russia, and it was widely held in Russia when I was there, at least, that Russia has been victorious in many, many wars, and that the Russian army has been quite victorious throughout history. And still, you can put an argument that Russia hasn't been famous for being very democratic or a very free society. So what would be your argument for explaining Russia?
It's a great question. Let us put it to Victor Davis Hanson. Yes. And thank you for your call. Here it is, Russia straddling Europe and Asia, East and West. How do you interpret its success or lack thereof?
Well, the great strength of Russia has always been, since the 19th century, its ability to emulate and import Western technology from Britain and Germany. And it does very well in that regard when it's attacked, whether it's in World War I for a while, especially World War II. And it does very poorly because it has not had a tradition of consensual government and freedom and civil audit over the military when it has to project power outside of Russia. For example, in the Russo-Japanese War, in Afghanistan and other situations. So it's westernized in the same way Japan was in World War II. I think that the future for Russia militarily will be much brighter because Russia is under a vast social and cultural transformation. I think ultimately it will have Western technology and Western values. I would say that I'm not so worried about the Muslim world as everybody else is. I mean, it's a billion people strong. But
worried in what sense, Victor Davis Hanson?
Well, we're told that the Muslim world is very strong. Actually, it's the weakest it's been since the 8th or 9th century. This is a all battles change the history of the world. And September 11th realigned the world. The two or three strongest military powers in the world now are United Europe and Russia and India and China. And of all those countries, three of those groups, three of them are actively pro-U.S., and China is neutral. And the Muslim world has found itself completely isolated, moderate governments terrified, and perhaps in its weakest geopolitical situation in years. And once we settle this terror, it's going to be very hard for moderate governments or any government to allow these people to function within their society.
But we're told that we're in a period of asymmetrical war, and we've seen that just a few people with box cutters and borrowed weapons, that is, planes, are able to inflict really serious damage, not just to one of our cities, but to our psyches.
Well, I mean, that's always
how does all this legacy get brought to bear in an asymmetrical war?
Well, there is such a thing, a concept, but all wars follow principles that are unchanged since classical times. We were at peace, just like we were at Pearl Harbor. And the enemy surprises due to a failure in intelligence. But once that peace was over, you will see traditional Western responses in the FBI, the CIA, the Immigration Service.
But we were surprised in an entirely new way. This wasn't fleets of dive bombers off of aircraft carriers. This was using, in fact, our own technology and our own openness against us.
It's always been the case in Western societies, though. People in the Persian War had agents inside Greece that were trying to undermine. Alexander the Great undermined the city-state. Same thing with the Carthaginians. It's always been the case that Western society in peace has vulnerability. It's outlined in Thucydides because of its open nature. But once war starts, those same vulnerabilities operate in reverse. People get vigilant. They come together. They use creative and individual and flexible responses. And look what we've done just in 3 weeks. We've rounded up nearly 1,000 suspects at terrorists. We've broken those networks. We're changing our policy radically. And we have a very efficient military actively engaged. And I think you're going to see that once people start to understand the power of the West, moderate governments in the Muslim world will want to join us rather than oppose us.
And Jack Mabidi, I guess even writing this great technology and this great heritage doesn't leave me feeling much complacency.
Well, no. I mean, we've had anthrax scares from every place, from the CIA to the Supreme Court. And in the war, you know, we have reports of high morale among Taliban troops. We have reports of a successful assassination or execution of an anti-Taliban leader. We have Northern Alliance commanders saying that the rate we're going, this is going to go a year or more. I mean, it's not clear to me that our forces being mustered there to any great effect thus far.
We're talking about the cultural roots of military prowess and how they might or might not be brought to bear successfully in this new war. Is history a good guide to predicting an outcome of the war on terror? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Or you can join the conversation online at WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with author and military historian Victor Davis Hanson about the cultural roots of military power. He's got a new book, Carnage and Culture, Landmark Battles and the Rise of Western Power, that outlines how Western science and philosophy and ideals over the centuries and more have put the West in a powerful military position again and again. How does it apply this time out? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Victor Davis Hanson, I want to just ask and try and move the conversation a little bit. Is there an evolution of context that changes the way that everything you describe is brought to bear? I guess with globalization, can we just aim for defeat, or do we need a new kind of victory? It's not the first or second century where we can just lay waste to an enemy and see that, I wouldn't think, as a desirable outcome. Can we?
Who believes that in the first and second century anybody thought they would just lay waste to an enemy? The Roman.
Oh, well, educate us. I think many of us have the sense that in the old days it was just, flatten the enemy and be done.
Roman foreign policy was very sophisticated, where indigenous religion was allowed to operate, local political entities were allowed, so that finally indigenous people, for example, in Palestine, were turning on Jewish zealots because they wanted the benefits of clean water and habeas corpus that Roman power provided. The rules of war and, I think, politics are timeless. Technology fools us that things change, but really the nature of man remains unchanged. As far as the earlier comment about execution of a Taliban resistance leader, we've got to remember that 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor, there was Wake Island and the Philippines. And after Little Bighorn, the next day people thought the American settlers were in trouble. After Isla Wanda, people... My gosh, it's only been 3 weeks.
You're saying there are always setbacks early on in a conflict.
Exactly, because the West is not a militaristic culture. It's culture. It's good at war. It's the best at war, but it's a product, a byproduct, an epiphenomenon. It's not the reason that Western culture exists. So it takes a while for a consensual government to get geared up. And we're seeing that right now. So one opposition leader killed, the inability within 3 weeks to find terrorists in this country the size of Texas, because we're an impatient people, fools us. But if you look at the larger historical forces that are now in play, it bodes very ill for Mr. bin Laden, for the Taliban, and any government that chooses to support them, not just because of military power, but also because the diplomatic, cultural, economic, and social forces coming into play.
Jack Beatty, help me out here. I hear Victor Davis Hanson loud and clear that there are timeless elements, but yet is there nothing about this new globalized world that changes the context, even for war?
Well, yeah. I mean, people have been saying, you know, that war among major powers today is unimaginable as an economic proposition. That is to say that if Germany and France went to war today, it would be so economically irrational that it would be you couldn't even contemplate it. The degree of interdependence makes it impossible. And interdependence doesn't really apply quite so much at all, really, to this part of the world. But I do share your feeling that somehow this vocabulary of war and victory and so on, when it's essentially after a kind of criminal enterprise, it seems – and our government had trouble from the beginning whether to call it war or, you know, a campaign. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of juggling around that, what really to call this. And since what you're after really here is terrorism, and since the dynamic of terrorism is that atrocity invites counter-atrocity, that is to say, if you were reply to the atrocity with war, with overwhelming war, you're giving the terrorists just what they want. So this is a very peculiar kind of war, and it challenges, I think, the vocabulary and the tradition of Western military history.
Victor Davis Hanson?
Yeah, I'd like to say I couldn't disagree more. In 1881, the great Mahdi energized resistance to both Egypt and England in Khartoum. He killed Chinese Gordon, and he had a mystical following of the great divine leader. And at one point, he had 10,000 leaders that stormed Khartoum. He might have controlled 1 million square miles. But by 1885, he was dead, and by 1898, the whole system was in shambles because of what? Traditional military power that made it clear to anybody who thought that they might want to join the great Mahdi that the price was simply too high to pay. If you had to ask anybody in Japan in 1939 or 1940, do you support Japanese militarists, they all would have said yes. By 1946, you couldn't have found a single person. Same thing in Germany. And if you had told anybody in England, is there any way we can dismantle Nazi Germany in 6 years, they would have thought you're crazy. But there wasn't a person in 1947 who believed or would say openly that fascism was a good thing. Why? It wasn't because the world had been reinvented, because the United States and its allies made the price too high to pay, and people saw where it ends. Same analogy. People in the Middle East have to understand that Islamic fundamentalism and terrorism leads nowhere. It pays a high price, both militarily, but also socially and politically. It's going to be very difficult for somebody from the Middle East, from Saudi Arabia or Egypt, to want to immigrate and study in Frankfurt now, or want to go to BU or Stanford University, and they're not going to like that.
They're,
because
they're,
of what because there's a whole, and it's going to be very hard to get a franchise for McDonald's or to get Jurassic Park. Whatever they say about anti-Westernism, Western culture is dynamic. It's crass. In some ways, it's amoral, but it's going to cut a lot of the world off. They're going to be cut off from it, and they're not going to like that.
There are many faces to this conflict. Let's turn for a moment to the wisdom and questions of our callers. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Alan is on the line. Welcome, Alan.
Hi. I've been listening to this and going back and forth between your guest and Jack Bedian's, thinking, gee, where am I going to go with this? Because I started out one way. But let me put it this way, because it's sort of slightly in between the two, it seems to me. I was very influenced by Robert Kaplan's The Coming Anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that should be mentioned much more in the present context, because it seems to me to be a prediction of what's happening now in a lot of ways.
What aspect are you talking about there,
Alan? There's corridors. He predicts that there would be corridors of prosperity, not necessarily nations, but that cut across nations.
Mm-hmm.
And that outside of that, you're going to have huge numbers of underprivileged that are nevertheless sitting on resources that we need. And that's going to be a kind of a terrorist breeding ground. That's the way I read him anyways.
Yeah, so here's maybe another example of this is clearly a new situation. And let's put it to Victor Davis Hanson. Thank you, Alan, for your call. Here's another thing that's different. We've got a bigger population than ever before. Does that make a difference or not?
In some ways it does, but not ultimately. We must remember that the United States is not a militaristic society. We did not want war. We just happen, as our history teaches us, to be very good at it. That doesn't mean that that's all we do.
But the folks opposing us here would say, maybe you didn't want war, but you've provoked us. And the argument, you know, buy it or not, goes all the way from having our soldiers sitting in Saudi Arabia guarding oil, to...
But there's a very good... I think that's one of the dangers of Western society in the 20th century, due to the influence of the Enlightenment, especially the deviant Enlightenment and Freud and Marx, that we look not rationally, but we always look for something we did psychologically, subconsciously, or economically. I want to examine your statement. The Muslim world is mad at us because of what? We saved Kuwait. We tried to save Shiites and Kurds in Iraq. We saved Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, you can debate any of these things. We saved Kuwait for whom?
Well, we saved
for what reason?
For oil and
a royal family there.
Well, the reason was that we were not killing and raping Kuwaitis in the streets like the Iraqis were. We were not butchering Shiites. We were not gassing Kurds.
This is true.
We did not let Islam die in Afghanistan, which the Soviets wanted. We fed people in Somalia. Europe was apparently willing to allow every Muslim in Bosnia and Kosovo to be exterminated by Christians. We didn't allow that. So we have done a lot for the Muslim world, but given the nature of our affluence, our education, our enlightenment, in the United States, it has to be 100% moral, not 95, not 75, before we turn self-critical. That's a very good tradition, but sometimes we've got to step back and look that people may, in fact, hate us, not because of what we've done, but because who we are.
Victor Davis Hanson, your book is deep, and you leave us with a lot to think about. We thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Victor Davis Hanson's new book is Carnage in Culture, Landmark Battles in the Rise of Western Power. He teaches classics at California State University in Fresno, and it's been great to have you on this evening. Thanks, Victor Davis Hanson. Jack Beatty, Victor Davis Hanson brings all of history to bear and says it's going to end up going our way. But minute to minute, it doesn't feel that way. I suppose it never has when war breaks out.
Yeah, well, he's certainly right about that. I mean, look at Pearl Harbor. In the wake of that, you had Wake Island, and then, of course, you had the Philippines, one of the biggest defeats ever administered on a U.S. Army. 50 or 75,000 American troops just rounded up out of the Bataan Peninsula by the Japanese. So, and that was in the wake of Pearl Harbor. So disasters happen in the early parts of war, especially for the United States, and for the reasons he says, we're inured to peace. Peace is our medium, and it takes us time. On the other hand, I'm not comforted by the long view somehow here, and I'm not really quite sure why, and it may be because this seems like a new kind of threat.
I suppose every time war breaks out, maybe it's inevitable that people feel this is new. It's usually a new enemy. It's always a new day. But somehow the combination of population, of globalization, of the strips of poverty and chaos that our caller referred to out of Robert Kaplan's book, they make me uneasy.
They make me uneasy, too. Kaplan's analogy, his figure, is that we're in a limousine. We're the West. We're in the limousine, and we're driving down the street, and there are all these wretched people looking at us. Now, that's a metaphor for the economic system of the world right now. And until those wretched people can get a better stake, we are vulnerable.
But still, our culture is at work, and as Victor Davis Hanson says, it has inexorably worked its way to victory again and again for centuries. We'll see how it turns out. Thanks, Jack Beatty.
Thank you.
Now, motherhood in a time of war. Add to the usual anxieties of an expectant mother war, anthrax, and a long campaign of terror. WBUR's Jennifer Schmidt spoke to four women at the Cambridge Birth Center about having a child in these uncertain times.
My name is Lucia Thompson, 4.5 months pregnant, and I think it's a very hard time to be expecting a child right now. I think with everything that's going on, not knowing what kind of world we're going to be living in even in February when the baby is due, and what kind of hazards we might face between now and then. It's literally not knowing what kind of world it is that we're bringing this child into, because it's a new world.
Stephanie Nelson. I am 34 weeks pregnant, which is about 8 months. And this is my second child, so I hope that for both of my kids that I can provide them with a safe and comforting environment. I'm actually, my husband and I are thinking quite seriously about moving away from the States. We were in Lower Manhattan on September 11th and witnessed the towers being struck, and that was definitely a clincher. And it's not actually that easy to even talk about. I don't want my kids to see that, you know, or experience it.
My name is Rachel E. Shalom, and I'm 7 months pregnant. This is my first child, and my hopes and dreams for my baby are that my baby should live by the Torah. And so the way I feel about it in terms of what's happening in the world right now, I mean, the world is constantly going through major tumult, and what we're seeing now is, you know, certainly incredibly devastating and disturbing on one level, but on another level, you know, we really believe in a higher order, and that this is all part of a much greater plan that we're unable to understand. So it's really about having faith in God.
My name is Charlotte Trim, and I'm 8.5 months pregnant, and my wishes for the baby are that she lives in a world of peace, and I guess things are going to be okay. Life is good. Life is more good than bad, and that goodness will always win through, you know? And I want this little girl to be part of a world that's connected and loving and not at war.
That was Charlotte Trim. We also heard from Lucia Thompson, Stephanie Nelson, and Rachel E. Shalom. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing more radio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions by email. The address is special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to